try it closer. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Hi over there.
Hi. A little cold, so I'm trying to stay.
Oh, okay. So it's lovely to be here with everyone today and to have sat through, along with all of the mind streams in the room. Today I wanted to talk about equanimity. And we always begin with that practice. We certainly apply it in our Zazen. It has to do with maintaining a steady presence. No matter what else is going on in the mind stream, thoughts, mood, sensation, whatever is going on in the outer realm, the inner realm, the attention and the application of heartfelt presence continues steadily. And equanimity is a it's a quality of the heart. It's actually one of the Brahma Viharas, one of the four divine abidings in the teachings. This teaching goes back way before Buddha. And we know that, one reason we know that is because it's called the Brahma Viharas. And Brahma was the god of creation in the Hindu telling. And Vihara is the dwelling place of Brahma. So these qualities that we are going to, we're going to look today into one of the four, equanimity, are the qualities that will enable us to dwell with Brahma, to dwell in the source of the world, to draw in the divine abiding. So they're also called the immeasurables, the four immeasurables, because when developed fully and integrated into our life, these attitudes, this attitude allows our mind to become immeasurable and vast, which the beauty of that is that everything that arises is included. There's nothing to come into opposition to. There's nothing that throws us off our love. So the Brahma Viharas are the four aspects of love. The first is metta, loving kindness, the kindness aspect of love. Then there's compassion, the feeling with love, that, or the knowing fully. I mean, as soon as you know another person really deeply, that's the same as loving them. As soon as you very deeply know your inmost experience, the sense of opposition to that disappears. So compassion is the inclusion aspect of love. And then there's sympathetic joy, mudita, which is taking joy in the happiness of others. Which is based in the realization that self and other are not separate, and that the happiness that someone else feels is the happiness that we feel. We can allow them to offer their happiness to our mind stream at this moment. There's no reason to remain so separate, not to benefit from others' happiness and good fortune. And then there's equanimity. So equanimity is misunderstood often to mean it is dispassion in a certain way, but it's the way that it's misunderstood is it can cause us to kind of bypass our feelings. However we feel, we rise above them. which is another form of separating from experience. So equanimity is not asking us to rise above, although there's that aspect because it's all inclusive. It's the most inclusive embrace, Brahma's embrace, the source, coming from the source. We focus on equanimity as our, in our practice, on the cushion. We call it different things, but it comes down to equanimity. We can call it focusing on the breath or listening to sound, but it's the even application of the neutral, of the neutral awareness. Awareness is a neutral capacity. It's a neutral functioning. It's always going on whether we are aware of it or not. That's the meaning of sentient awareness. All beings are sentient. All beings respond to the environment, and we respond according to what we become aware of. And in practice, we become aware of awareness itself. That's the meaning of the relative and the absolute. The absolute is rather the largest awareness that is always volunteering itself, whether we are aware of it or not. And then the relative is the content of awareness, whatever forms fill awareness. So one example would be the sound that fills awareness, the ear awareness, hearing awareness, right? Or sight, or thought, which is immaterial, but it certainly fills awareness at times. It becomes concrete. And we mistake it for real. It's a thought. It has reality in certain ways, but it's not real. Not in the absolute way. So when we're practicing equanimity in meditation, where nothing is stirring but the mind, that's hard enough. Do you find that that's true? How much more so is it difficult to practice equanimity when we are swept up in the world of activity and motion, our own and everyone and everything else's, all the time? Equanimity. So the Sanskrit word is upekkha, and it refers to the observing aspect. The observing aspect of takes hold of the observing aspect, the ability to take a look at in a neutral state of mind, coming back to neutral. What is your neutral mind? We don't use that word too often in Dharma teachings, but it's really useful, I think. It's really apt. It implies holding a larger perspective, not getting swept in, not getting entirely swept in. That doesn't mean pushing it away and separating. It just means letting it sweep through awareness. Upekkha is one of the terms that the Buddha uses in the Pali Canon for this. But the second word that he used was tatra majjhatata, meaning to stand in the middle of all these things when everything is in motion. To stand in the middle of all these things. Well, what's happening when you're just standing, you know, you're in your car idling, you're in neutral. Just this. So remaining centered in the middle of whatever is happening is really another way of saying presence, practicing with presence. And remaining in the middle when everything is happening, I'm thinking we have a couple of musicians, three musicians, maybe more than I don't know about, in this room at the moment. And that's, what is it when playing that is remaining in the middle as the play goes along. You know, you can look at that in any activity that we do. What is it that remains in the middle?
Rhythm. Pulse.
That's content.
Content, okay.
That's content. And then you go to
awareness.
Shared awareness. That is the content of awareness. But awareness is always operating outside of our own determination. So why would we want to develop equanimity in our lives? What are some of the reasons to develop equanimity? I'll open that up. Or maybe not. Is this worthwhile? Is this something you want to do? Okay, so why?
I would say in order to open yourself up to, like the second part of it, open yourself up to others' pain, because if you're not equanimous, then how can you be aware of other people? That's the best answer I can come up with. Yeah.
Opening to others' pain.
Leading to wisdom by stepping back.
Leading
so when one sees a broad, wider perspective, one comes
uh-huh.
toward wisdom.
It helps us. Yeah. Okay. Anything else?
As you
kiss me.
As you talk about it, what it comes to me is if I don't have equanimity, like always, that means I judge. So equanimity for me would be not judging during interactions, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then that, because when I judge, then I'm separated.
So you become free. It frees you from judging.
Mm-hmm. It gives me that gap moment in a situation where it just gives me a little bit of space that I don't have to react from habit, but I can have the opportunity to react from maybe my better place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So gives you a gap to stay true to what feels better, what is more true. Yeah. Any other?
Yeah. For me, it opens. It's like a camera aperture, kind of opens it up. instead of a tiny little plot, it's a huge field.
An opener.
Opener.
A more open life.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Okay. So the Buddha says there are several reasons for equanimity, and I think we've just touched on them. If your mind becomes firm like a rock and no longer shakes, these are his words, in a world where everything is shaking, your mind will be your greatest friend and suffering will not come your way. If your mind becomes firm like a rock and no longer shakes. So how does it feel when your mind no longer shakes? Well, that's a sense of peace, of openness, of stability, of confidence. You can relax. When this is part of faith mind, is this deep relaxation that all can be accommodated, all can be allowed in without fear and reactivity, one way or another, whether we know how at the moment or not, right? And then when we can't work with equanimity, when we can't cultivate this practice, we're filled with anxiety and worry, and we're easily disturbed and distracted and pulled around. So there's a Taoist story, and most of you probably have heard it. I love this story. It's taken me years to emulate this old farmer who worked his crops for many years, and one day his horse runs away. Upon hearing the news, his neighbors come to visit and say, oh, such bad luck. They're very sympathetic. And he says, well, maybe. The next morning, the horse returns, bringing with it three other wild horses. How wonderful, the neighbors exclaim. Maybe, replied the old man. The following day, his son tries to ride one of the untamed horses and is thrown and breaks his leg. And the neighbors again come over to offer their sympathy for his misfortune. And he says, well, maybe. Maybe this is misfortune. Well, the day after that, the military office officials come to the village to draft young men into the army for the coming war. And seeing that the son's leg is broken, they pass him by. The neighbors congratulate the farmer on how well things have turned out. Maybe, says he. We could tell this story using all the details of developing Sangajul Zen Center.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Every time something comes along, initially, we were all like, oh no. And now we're like, oh, okay, well, let's keep going and see how this turns, right?
How about the deer eating the leaves off the trees? What's the possible benefit of that?
We'll
maybe.
See.
Well, it depends on if you're the deer.
Yeah.
From their perspective.
Yeah, what's the possible that we are forming a relationship. It's a real intimate relationship with some of these deer. And those of us who were there yesterday for the Zazen Kai, at the end of the day, there was a deer hanging out at the edge of the garden, and boy, it was really relating to us. It was really, I mean, it was waiting until we left to eat whatever we put in, but it was something other than that. There was an attunement that was really palpable. Mm-hmm. And who knows? I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's what we're faced with, you know? It's one thing to put up a deer fence, and that would have brought a whole mm-hmm. other set of blessings and difficulties mm-hmm. and sense experiences. And then to decide not to put up a deer fence brings us into profound not knowing. We don't know how this is going to go, and we also don't know what's going to end up being planted in the garden, because it's going to change some things. And getting to know deer a little bit more. I've never had ongoing relationship with deer, and now this is my opportunity. I mean, there's a lot of material there for future Dharma talks having to do with what the deer can point out about our current moment in the world. But I'll stay with my talk today. But anyway, equanimity, another aspect of equanimity is it's don't know mind. You know, that maybe. I don't know. I don't know if it's good fortune or if it's not. It's not one or the other. This is not being tied to opposites, not being tied to fixed positions, but saying, oh, there's always more. There's always more to any one moment, any one stand that is revealed at the time. And living according to don't know mind is part of wisdom. Part of wisdom. Because that's the character of every moment. It's vast. All kinds of possibilities. So equanimity is also practicing don't know mind. Second reason to cultivate, according to the Buddha, is you stay connected and loving with things as they are. Whatever comes up, you can say, this too is part of my life, and I can work in a caring and patient way. This too gives me an opportunity to open my heart and my functioning and free me from constrictions that keep me from being able to be flexible and in full relation to everything that's moving all the time. So as our life becomes lighter, we're less worried by stuff that comes along, it becomes more amusing. I mean, you know, initially the deer would show up and we'd go, oh, and now it shows up and we just laugh. And it's not a skeptical laugh, it's a warm-hearted, like, oh, here we are all together in this situation. And this really adds to our confidence in life, to be whole and complete and not have to worry when it's not what we think, because most things are unknown. We know a narrow strip, and mostly we don't know everything else at the moment. The Buddha's third reason to cultivate equanimity is we can't control what another person will do. Boy, that's for sure. That's an important one. That's an important one all the way from our own families, partners, people we work with. You know, the city ordinances. I mean, we can't control other. So here's a story. This comes from the Buddha's time. A very wealthy merchant named Anathapindika, who we actually know of through other stories, because he provided a gathering place for monks to gather with the Buddha for teachings in the winter during the rains. Anathapindika was a great supporter of the Buddha. He was renowned for his generosity, and not just to the Buddhist monks and other recluses. He also provided the capital for many of his relatives to start businesses. But Anathapindika had a spendthrift relative who squandered the gifts and investments and repeatedly asked for more. Each time Anathapindika tried to help, but finally he said, no more, that's it. The relative continued his spendthrift habits, fell into debt, and in not too long a time died, and his body was thrown on the rubbish heap. When Anathapindika heard about this, he felt terrible. In grief, he spoke with the Buddha, asking, should I have given him more money? And the Buddha's response was that there was nothing more that Anathapindika could do. He did what he could do with a pure intention, but he could not control how another person used those resources. That's another form of freeing us, isn't it? We do what we can do. We can offer the Dharma freely, far and wide, but only those who take it up. I mean, it's up to other in that way. We can offer our resources, our love, our wealth, our energies, but we can't go beyond that. That's all that we're in charge of. I think that's really important. Some of you may have relatives or a sibling, and we need to have equanimity when we've done what we can do, and there's nothing more we can do. And sometimes that involves trying over and over again to be sure. You know, it's like getting over addiction, whether it's to drugs or to certain kinds of abusive relationships, can take a number of starts. I quit smoking like 7 times before I finally quit. I mean, that's characteristic of quitting really long practiced habits. So you might want to keep trying to help somebody else out. But there is a time when that's it. There's nothing more you can do. All of us are owners of our own deeds. Even when things don't turn out the way we want them to, equanimity imbues the mind with a calm radiance, says the Buddha, a calm radiance. We are the owners of our deeds. In the 5 remembrances that we chant at times, 5 remembrances, my deeds are my closest companions. I am the beneficiary of my deeds. So that's what we can, that's what we're responsible for, is what we do with our life, what choices we make. So therefore, the thing, you know, during Zazen, I said that small shift from having, when you fall into reverie or thinking or something, it is just a short shift into presence. And that's a choice that can be made. We always can do that if we remember and realize the opportunity. So, Thoreau said, we could not help contrasting the equanimity of nature with the bustle and impatience of man. The equanimity of nature is seen all around. I think that's just a terrific thought. You go, I mean, anywhere it's demonstrated, but I immediately I think of a walk that I take regularly, and the everything that's fallen, and it lies where it lies. You know, trees and leaves, and it doesn't have to be cleaned up and tidied up, and it's the equanimity of nature. It is, rain falls where it falls. It does not choose the surfaces that it falls upon. That's also an image that's used in metta, which is metta practice, loving kindness practice, is the extending of a wide loving heart to all in our field, not picking and choosing. That's the quality of love, of a loving heart. Not a heart with an agenda, not a conditional love heart, but metta, loving kindness, is a practice that includes all in it. So I wanted to read you a short passage from David Hinton's Hunger Mountain, which I would encourage everybody to read. It's just a remarkable book. David Hinton is he's really awake. He's a Buddhist practitioner, but he's never been in any particular tradition, but he walks constantly and he writes. And so his Hunger Mountain is one of the places he walks regularly, and it's all about some of the nature writings in the Chinese Buddhist tradition. It's a fascinating book. It's a wonderful book, very inspiring. A mountain can be a great teacher, he says, not only because it manifests that cosmology of sincerity and restless hunger with such immediacy and drama, but also because it stands apart, at once elusive and magisterial. Its imposing and indifferent presence reminds me yet again that things in and of themselves remain beyond us. Even after the most exhaustive and accurate scientific or philosophical account, the most compelling mythology, or the most concise and penetrating poem, things in and of themselves remain beyond us. That's a pure Zen statement. And because that's really the truth of our experience, is it's direct. We talk about it a lot, we think about it a lot, we add a lot to it, but the direct experience is always beyond us. It has nothing to do with me. It is what it is. So practicing equanimity is really fun, because it's kind of mischievous. I find it kind of mischievous in that things always have a meaning, whatever happens. has a meaning. And then when you find yourself captured in reaction to recognize one's own foolishness in thinking that things should fall in line with what I want or what I expect, is really, it's fun. It's fun to do that. Not to make light of all of the difficulties in the world, and that does not relieve us from responding to some very, so many circumstances in the world demand that we respond. But from a place of equanimity, of wisdom, of appreciating all that we don't know about it, and still having to respond from our vows, from our bodhisattva vows, to refrain from doing harm and to do good and do good for others. So I hope this inspires you to remember the practice of equanimity in your daily round. And looking around and seeing each of you, I'm sure you already do that. So, thank you for listening.